Good morning. I really wanted to continue with our discussion from last week. What we spoke about, just to remind everybody, was the general rise in anti-Semitism. All of us are familiar. It just so happens that when we were giving the shiur last week, I was unaware of what was going on with Whoopi Goldberg. That was that morning. So it really takes on a whole nother level. We also spoke about the concept of being the Am HaNivchar and what that is supposed to mean for all of us, for our community, for our children, for our grandchildren, and for the continuity of the Jewish people. One of the existential challenges that we face as a people and as a nation is that so many in the Jewish community have lost this understanding and appreciation of what it means to be the Am HaNivchar. That is really what we touched upon at the end of the shiur last week. And through the horrors of assimilation that we have experienced, so many have given up on their commitment, on their fidelity to a life of Torah and observance of mitzvos. And it's such a great tragedy. And as we mentioned, it's really an existential threat to what the Jewish people are and where we are going to be. About 2 months ago, I had a very pleasant lunch meeting with a prominent female Reform rabbi from Manhattan who originally stems from South Korea. She's an extremely genuine person, and we spent time talking about our feelings about Eretz Yisrael and a number of other Jewish communal matters that are of concern to both of us, one of us. We were just exchanging ideas, talking about different things. And many parts of the discussion were very fascinating for both of us, but at some point, how we ended up in this meeting is a good question for another time, but at some point she asked me, you know, Rabbi, how do you teach so much? How do you have time for this? I don't understand. I'm looking through your schedule. How do you have so much time to teach? And I said to her that my personal feeling is that without a firm commitment to perpetuate Torah values and ideas, there will not be a Jewish community in the future, period. And if you don't invest of your time to teach, and you don't make sure to educate your people, we won't have a Jewish people. And as we know, we have been referred to as the people of the book, because that is exactly who we are. We are only a people because we have a book, because we have our Torah, and because we represent all that the Torah expects of us to uphold and represent in the world. And I asked her, you know, I'm just curious, how many members? She has 3,000 families in her congregation. Makes us look small. So I said to her, how many of the 3,000 families in your community attend any form of Jewish day school, Reform, conservative, non-denominational? How many attend any kind of Jewish day school at all? The answer that she gave me, I will not share in public, but it was so deeply disturbing and sad to me. She did not give me a statistic. She gave me an exact number of families, which was so pathetically sad. But this sense of remaining committed to being different, to being the Am HaNivchar, to the Torah and mitzvos that all of us are supposed to be keeping, is something that unfortunately is so lost in our generation, and it's something that should be very painful to us. You know, a couple of years ago, the Pew report came out about where things are holding in the Jewish community, and many people were celebrating, oh, you see that the Orthodox are on the rise, and you see how successful we've been in building our communities. And I cried when I read that, because you see what a tragedy it is. Yes, the Orthodox are on the rise, but you see that such a large percentage of Jewish community life in America is gone and do not affiliate at all with what we know to be the Jewish people. So I just want to read to you a couple of paragraphs. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks wrote a lot about assimilation and anti-Semitism. There's a lot that he has in many of his books. I happen to love his writings. I'm sure many of you do as well. But he wrote a letter that was called, Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? I don't know if you've ever read that. But it's a very powerful letter that I think, if I remember correctly, he wrote to his children. I think every year before Rosh Hashanah, he used to write a very nice message to his children. And it was really just an opportunity for him to give a message to the world, but he blamed it on writing a letter to his children. But one year he wrote something very profound, and he titled it, Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? So I just want to read you a little bit from that, because I really think it brings home this point very powerfully. After the Shoah, he says, one phrase came to encapsulate the collective response of world Jewry. That phrase was, nobody's a child of Holocaust survivors? Never again. Never again would we stand by defenseless as Jews were dying because they were Jews. Yet, albeit in a radically different form, it is happening again. Admittedly, it is not Jews who are dying, but it is no less significant from the perspective of Jewish continuity. Judaism and Jewish identity are dying. That which made us Jews and gave us shape and meaning to our lives is dying. Every nation that suffered casualties during the Second World War has since repopulated itself, except for the Jewish people. For every Jewish child who perished in the Holocaust, there is a child today who could have been enjoying a free and secure Jewish identity, but is not, because one of his parents is not Jewish, or because he has no understanding or knowledge of what it is to be a Jew. It's so profound, and it's so obvious and simple, but it's so true. We live in a community where we look at what goes on in our community, and we say, look at the explosive growth of the Orthodox community. But look at the tragedy of the rest of the Jewish community, and understand how tragic it really is, and what an existential threat that is for all of us. He writes in a different part of that, when I was last in America, my eye was caught by a story on the front page of the New York Times. The heading was, The Assimilating Bagel. And the tale it told was this, a bagel was once a hard, round roll with a large hole in the center. It was a Jewish delicacy, which you ate with cream cheese or smoked salmon, and temporarily forgot the troubles of the world. I didn't know that that's what bagels are for, but apparently. According to the New York Times, the bagel was subtly changing. Its crust was getting softer, the hole was getting smaller. Little by little, the bagel was assimilating into a bun, and it was no longer a bagel. For bagel, he writes, read Jewry in America. And the metaphor is clear. Jewish identity in America is vanishing with frightening, unprecedented speed. Throughout the diaspora, with minor regional variations, one half of young Jews is deciding not to have a Jewish marriage, not to build a Jewish home, and not to have Jewish children. Each such loss is a tragedy. A family tree that has lasted 100 generations has come to an end with this individual. A chain of continuity that held strong for 100 generations has now been broken. And I'll read you one final thing that he has from that letter. My grandparents were not born in this country. He's talking about Great Britain. Many, even most of the Jews in Britain, had grandparents who came here in the great wave of immigration from Eastern Europe between 1880 and 1914. We are Anglo-Jews of the third generation. This is an astounding phenomenon that he points out. It is an almost universal law that inherited wealth lasts three generations and not more. And the same applies to inherited Judaism. Ours is the last generation that can still remember a Bubba and a Zeta from the Haim, with their fluent Yiddish and undiminished Yiddishkeit. Ours is the last generation for whom Jewish identity can be sustained by memory alone. The Gerer Rebbe once pointed out that the four sons of the Haggadah represent four generations. The wise son is the immigrant generation who still lives the traditions of his home that he was familiar with. The rebellious son is the second generation who has forsaken Judaism for social integration. The simple son is the third generation who is very confused by the mixed messages of religious grandparents and irreligious parents. Sound familiar? But the child who cannot even ask, the She'eni Yodea Lishol, is the fourth generation. The child of the fourth generation no longer even has memories of Jewish life in its full intensity. Our children are children of that fourth generation. Already it is clear that what we took for granted, they do not. They do not take it for granted that they will belong to an Orthodox synagogue or indeed to any synagogue. Talk to millennials today. Look what's going on in the world, and we know this to be true. They do not take it for granted that they will marry in the first place, and certainly they do not take it for granted that they will marry another Jew, or that they will stay married. They do not take it for granted that they will have children, or certainly that they will have Jewish children. That is not important to them. Nothing can be taken for granted in the fourth generation, least of all in the secular open society in which even a common moral code seems to be lacking. And I think he is so on point with his description of what we're seeing. And after I met with this leader of that community, I understood how real this reality is to the Jewish community at large. And sometimes we focus too much. And again, we need to focus on our community because we have plenty to do. Don't point fingers and say the problem is with assimilation. Yes, that is a major problem. But our children are also that fourth generation. Our children have no understanding of what it means to be that image of what a Jew once was. That does not exist for them. And they cannot live an existence, an experience of just having a memory of what a Jew was. They need to really understand what it means to be the Am HaNivchar, what it means for them, not out of memory, but out of practice, but out of observance, out of what it really means in a very practical sense. You know, in Parshas Vayishlach, we read about the encounter between Yaakov Avinu and his sadistic adversary, the Sarosh HaLeisav. And Rashi tells us, the Midrashim tell us, And in the midst of this ferocious battle that's described in the Medrash, the Torah records a very amusing exchange. It's very uncomfortable. It's very strange. And we're told that here they are fighting with each other, Yaakov Avinu, Sarash Alesav, and suddenly Yaakov turns to the angel and he says, Hagida Nashemecha, tell me your name. To which the angel responds, a very strange response. Lama zeh tishal shmi, why are you asking my name? Rav Soloveitchik points out, if you have the Chumash, the Mesoras HaRav Chumash at home, if you don't have it, it's an amazing set of Chumashim, you should buy it. But I get no royalties, so I have nothing involved in that pitch, but I have found it to be very inspiring, a lot of really beautiful comments. And if you're inspired by Rav Soloveitchik, but you just don't know where to find something, they have curated so many of his ideas from different books and different svarim, all into that Chumash, so it's a very nice resource. So he points out that it's very strange. I ask somebody, what is your name? So there's a number of responses you can have when I ask that question. The Malach could have said, I do not need to tell you my name. I don't want you to know who I am. Or, God has instructed me not to tell you my name. It's private. Or, I do not have a name. I actually have no identity. But his response is so inappropriate. His response is, Lama zeh tishal shmi? Why are you asking my name? What a strange response. I'm asking because I'm interested in knowing who I'm talking to. It's a very obvious question that Yaakov Avinu asked. And Rav Soloveitchik explained that in many ways, this story of the anonymous attacker, of the Sarash Alesav that we don't know much about, really in many ways represents the most challenging characteristic of all of Jewish destiny. And that is that the Jew never really knows how to clearly identify who the enemy is, who they are fighting against. Will it be the Greeks? Will it be the Romans? Will it be Hitler? Will it be Stalin? Will it be Nazism, socialism? Will it be anti-Semitism? Will it be communism? Will it be Esau? Will it be Lavan? Will it be Yavan? We have so many different options. Will it be the global challenges that we face of just such a breakdown of moral clarity, the age of enlightenment, social discrimination, all that we see going on in the world, that the world is falling apart right in front of our eyes. All of that is the challenge that the Jewish people face. And yet, it was at that moment that Yaakov Avinu was taught that he was engaged in a battle that would never be clear to him, because this is the never-ending struggle of who the Jewish people are. We don't exactly know how to explain the essence of who our enemy is, because it is never going to be the same. And you cannot look at what the last generation had to fight and think that that is going to be the fight of our generation. Yaakov Avinu asked, allow me to identify who the enemy is. Allow me to understand and properly strategize what I'm dealing with, what challenge you represent, how I'm supposed to prepare myself to fight, to which he was told, Lama zeh tishal shmi, it doesn't help. Even if I tell you my name, it's not going to do anything for you, because in the future that name will change and the identity will change. And the precise battle that you are facing is something that is never going to be the same from one generation to the next. In fact, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin a fascinating detail about that episode in Chumash between Yaakov Avinu and Sarash Alesav. The Gemara has a machlokas, a dispute, whether the Sarash Alesav came in the guise of a great Talmud Chacham, or did he come in the guise of an idol worshiper, of an Oved Avodah Zarah. So you'll say it's a detailed discussion. Did he look like this? Did he look like that? What's the difference? It doesn't really matter. But some suggest that really it does matter, because sometimes the fight of the Jewish people comes in the guise of an Oved Avodah Zarah, where we see that we have an opponent who is very different from what we are and what we represent, follows a different religion, has a whole different set of values and morals than we have, and it's very easy to fight that. It's very easy to keep my identity and to understand that that identity is different. What's far more complicated is when the person comes in the guise of a great Torah scholar, of a great Talmud Chacham. And today, I feel that that is a much greater challenge. Now that we have the internet, and we have all kinds of programs, and people can educate themselves, and it's not hard to present oneself as being a great Torah scholar in whatever community the person is from. It's very easy to pass yourself off to others as a knowledgeable individual who is really giving over Torah values and Torah lessons. And that, says the Gemara, is no less of a challenge. In fact, I believe it's a much greater challenge, because it's far more difficult to identify that person and that threat when it comes in the form of someone who looks like we look. who seems to practice the way we practice and who believes in all that we seemingly believe in. What's very interesting is there is a Gemara in Maseches Megillah. Sometimes we read the story, we're already in Chodesh Adar. I know that it's only Adar Rishon. We're going to still have the opportunity, Adar Sheni. But we already are thinking about Purim, I hope. We're already beginning to think about Purim. And the Gemara has a lot of stories about Haman and Ahasuerus and filling in the details. When you read the Megillah, you don't get the full story, obviously. And there's a lot more behind that we're not fully aware of. So sometimes when we read the story of Purim, so, you know, you have young children who dress up as Ahasuerus and they say, oh, he was a great king, and in the end, everything worked out, everything was wonderful. But when you read the story that the Gemara shares us about Ahasuerus, he was as great an anti-Semite as Haman was. He was together, hand in hand with Haman. He was trying to pull off exactly what Haman wanted to do. They were no different at all. They both shared a great and deep hatred for the Jewish people, and they wanted to destroy them. Haman's the one who came up with the plan, but Ahasuerus was there right alongside him. So the Gemara, when describing the story of Ahasuerus and Haman and their relationship, the Gemara tells us something very strange. Listen carefully. Mashal de Ahasuerus. How would you describe this relationship of Haman and Ahasuerus? Lemah davar domeh. Says the Gemara, l'shnei b'nei Adam, you have two people. Echad hayalo tel b'soch sadehu. You have two people who each own property, they each have a field, and they're very good friends. One of them has a problem, and his problem is he has a big mound of dirt in the middle of his field. Now the problem is, when you have that, you can't do any work on the field because you have this big mound of dirt in the way. So what are you supposed to do? Well, Echad, his friend, has a big ditch in the middle of his field. So he also can't do any work because every time he's going to try to bring the animals out to work, they're going to fall into the ditch, so he doesn't know what to do. One fine day, they're both in the supermarket together, they're talking, and each one is saying to the other, you know, I have a major problem. I really can't do any work on the field because I have this mound in the way. I don't know how to get rid of it. I don't know where to put it. The other one says, that's amazing because I have the opposite problem. I have a big ditch in my field, and it's going to cost me a fortune to have it filled, but at the same time, if I don't fill it, I'm unable to do any work. I can't really have any produce come out of this land. So the Gemara says that they're looking at each other, and finally they say, you know, let's make a deal. How about every day you'll bring a little bit of dirt from your field, you'll put it into my ditch, and over time, both of us will be happy. You'll be able to work your field, I'll be able to work my field, you don't have to pay to have your dirt taken away, I don't have to pay to have the dirt filled in, and everything's great. The Gemara says that that's what they did, and they were both very excited about this arrangement. And that is the story of Haman and Ahasuerus. Period. So what does that mean? What is the Gemara trying to teach us? The Gemara doesn't tell us the Nimshel, doesn't say, and therefore Haman was like this, Ahasuerus was like that. So I remember a couple of years ago, Rabbi Asher Weiss was in my house, and I was learning this Gemara was right before Purim, and he said, oh, Shai, what do you think? What does the Gemara mean? I said, I actually have no idea. I read that Gemara many times, but I just didn't pay attention to it, because I had no idea what it was trying to teach us. And he suggested a very interesting historical interpretation. And I think it really brings this Gemara alive, and this Gemara to be very relevant. You know, we're familiar with a passage, Halacha biyadua she'esav sone liyakov. I'm sure many have heard that. It's just a known fact that there's anti-Semitism in the world. This is the way it is. And we've learned to live with that. Rav Asher joked at the time, Halacha biyadua she'esav sone liyakov. You know, some people are very strict in keeping halacha, and they make sure to keep it to the nth degree. The Umas HaOlam are very strict in this halacha, biyadua she'esav sone liyakov, and they make sure that they fulfill it in the most outrageous of ways, in the most atrocious and barbaric, inhumane forms. And we've seen that. The extermination of the Jewish people over so many centuries and so many generations, and massacres and so many catastrophes, and terror attacks and genocide against the Jewish people, we've seen it. But this is what it is. And there is no logic, there is no reason, there is no justification, there is no rationale. There is no pattern for why it is that there's hatred against the Jewish people. In communities where the Jewish people have made major contributions, where they have shown their tremendous commitment to the society that they're living in, where they have advanced the society and strengthened the economy, they are hated. In communities where they've been faithful and loyal, where they've done everything to show that they believe in the cause that everybody else believes in, where they've been patriotic and gone along with all of the social norms of that society, somehow it's turned on their heads and they've become the hated people. Think about the expulsion in Spain in the 1400s. And there you read about in history the Abarbanel. We're all familiar with the Abarbanel. So he's a commentary on Chumash, one of the great Rishonim. The Abarbanel actually was the treasurer in Spain. Right? Like on our dollar bills, signed whoever the treasurer's name is now. That used to say Abarbanel, whatever his name was. And yet, with having a great Jew, who was a very upstanding person, who was a part of the government at the time, in a very pronounced way, came the Spanish expulsion. You cannot say that it was just, you know, the hatred of the Jews because they're subhumans. It was the hatred of the Jews because they were so successful. And yet, in other generations, you find in the opposite direction. You have in Germany, before the war, there was such assimilation and such integration. Tens of thousands of Jews became part of other movements and no longer wanted to identify as Jews. Ultimately, they were found. But what happened at the time? What happened was there was a word out there that the Jews were subhumans, that the Jews were not too influential and too powerful. They were not too prosperous. It was not a sense of jealousy, but rather it was this understanding that Jews don't have a right to live because they're less than animals, because they're just not part of the human race. And that was a very different kind of hatred toward the Jewish people. I'm going to read you again from Rabbi Sacks. As I said, he has so much about this topic. But I think he brings this point home very beautifully, where he says, "Anti-Semitism is not a unitary phenomenon, a coherent belief or ideology. Jews have been hated because they were rich. Jews have been hated because they are poor, because they have been capitalist, and because they are communists. Jews have been hated because they believed in tradition, and Jews have been hated because they were rootless cosmopolitans, because they kept to themselves, and because they penetrated everywhere. Anti-Semitism is not a belief, but rather a virus." Beautiful way to say it. "The human body has an immensely sophisticated immune system which develops defenses against viruses. It is penetrated, however, because viruses mutate." Anti-Semitism mutates. It's a virus, and it mutates. And every generation, there's a new mutation and a new threat, and you never know exactly what it's going to be. "Jews were hated in Germany because they were rich and because they were poor, because they were capitalist and because they were communists, because they kept to themselves and because they infiltrated everywhere, because they believed in primitive faith and because they were rootless cosmopolitans who believed nothing. Hitler believed that Jews were controlling both the United States and the Soviet Union. How can they be doing both? How could Hitler say that they were both running the United States decision-making process as well as the Soviet Union? And the answer is because they were Jews. Because they were Jews. That is the history of anti-Semitism. And Rav Asher Weiss explained that perhaps this is what the Gemara means to teach us when describing the story of Haman and Ahasuerus, the Baal HaTel and the Baal HaCharitz. Anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism. It's a reality in the world that we're not going to get rid of. However, there are different dimensions to anti-Semitism. Sometimes they look at us as the Baal HaTel. Sometimes they look at us as we're too successful. We're a big heap, a big mound of society. We're infiltrating every aspect of government. Every political advocacy group has Jews involved in it. Every corner of this society has Jews that are very successful. And some look at the Jews as the Baal HaTel, the big mound that's in the way, that we don't know how to get rid of. And there are others who see this very differently. There are others who see the Jewish people as subhumans. There are others who see the Jewish people as the Baal HaCharitz, as the big hole right in the middle of, as the big hole right in the middle of the field. That is the Baal HaCharitz. Really, I'm just going to announce again. I think at some point in the next two or three weeks, we're going to stop the Zoom option. All of you are welcome to come back here and join us in the shul. There's room upstairs. There's room downstairs. We have masks for everybody. It's just become very, very distracting for the people who are here. So I invite you all to join us once again. But the Baal HaCharitz is the other form of anti-Semitism, which is that sometimes the anti-Semite looks at the Jewish religion, at the Jewish people, as being the one who is subhuman, who's just a big ditch, a big hole right in the middle of society that we need to fill. But both of them come to the same place. Haman and Ahasuerus shake hands and are in business together. They come from different angles, they have different perspectives, but in the end they both meet in the middle because they have a common goal. And don't ever fool yourself that anti-Semitism, no, it's not this, it's not that, it's all the same. It's all the same. And you study the history of anti-Semitism and you understand this is what it's always been, this is what it will continue to be. Halacha biyadua she'esav sone le'yakov. I've said this medrash in the past, but every time I talk about it, I find that I'm inspired. A couple of years ago, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau was in town for Shabbos. I think he was by the Young Israel of Lawrence Cedarhurst. I don't remember exactly where. But it was very nice that on Matzah Shabbos, they had a gathering of all the Rabbanim in the community came together, and they had a Malava Malka together with Rabbi Sachs. I'm sorry, with Rabbi Lau. And at the time, it just so happened, I was actually excited. I love Rabbi Lau, as I'm sure many people here do as well. And I'm totally enamored by him. So, it so happens that that Shabbos was the week of the Pittsburgh massacre. So right after Shabbos, we all heard about it. You know, none of us were watching TV on Shabbos. Nobody was listening to the news or holding their phones. And right after Shabbos is when we heard about the great tragedy that happened there. And Rabbi Lau was scheduled to speak about something else. But he came and he was so shaken up. It was right after Shabbos that we had this get-together. And he said, you know, I've been living my whole life fighting against this. And never in a million years did I think that I would be in the United States of America, in the land of the free, the home of the brave, and I would have to address an attack that happened in a synagogue? That even here, you're not safe? That you don't have the religious freedoms that you thought you had? That people are so intolerant in a democratic society like we live in? And he was so shaken up, and he said, whatever I was going to speak about, I won't speak about. But instead, he shared his very raw feelings that he felt at the time. Now, if you ever heard Rabbi Lau speak, he's an amazing orator, really, an unbelievable speaker. It's an understatement. And Rabbi Lau at the time spent, I think it was 45 minutes speaking, and all he said was one paragraph in a medrash. But the way, I don't know how to do this, but the way that he developed, you know, and made drama out of one little passage in a medrash was phenomenal. It was amazing. So I'm really not doing justice, I'm sorry. But it was really something that made a tremendous impact on me. And what he said was that the Medrash talks about the history of anti-Semitism against the Jewish people, the history of killing, the history of murderers. And the Medrash says that each one turned to his friend, each one turned to the one that came before them, and started pointing out the mistakes that they made in their attempts to annihilate someone else. So the Medrash tells us as follows. Esav, as we know, goes down in history as pretty evil, pretty bad, rotten person. So Esav is trying to figure out, how does he get rid of the Jewish problem? He hates his brother Yaakov, and he just needs to do whatever he can to destroy him. So he looks back in history, and he says, who was the first murderer in the history of the world? Cain. So as we know, Torah says that there was some jealousy between Cain and Hevel, something happened there. And Cain decides he's going to murder his brother. So Esav says, let me go study what happened there and see what I can learn. See whether there's anything I can apply to my situation from what happened there. So the Medrash writes that Esav's thinking about it, and after a while he says to himself, Shote haya Cain. Cain really made a big mistake. Because he was jealous that he had another brother involved in the equation. And therefore he decided he needed to kill him. But the problem was he didn't take into account that his parents were still alive. So long as his parents are alive, they can have another subsequent child. And then I'm back to where I started. So what good did I do for myself? After all, if I know that I've gotten rid of one brother, but down the line there's going to be another, I'm going to have the issue again. So Cain made a real mistake, and the truth is, the Torah tells us that after a while, Adam and Chava have another child. What do they name him? Shase. Why do they name him Shase? Kishas li Elokim zera acher tachas hevel b'ni. Because we lost a child whose name was Hevel, we had to make up for that. How do we make up for it? By having another child. Again, obviously that can never replace a child that was lost. It's a tragedy. It's a horrible tragedy. And especially that one child murdered another. I mean, who can do such a thing? But yet, Adam and Chava felt we have to do something to try to rehabilitate ourselves. And that's what they do. They have another child. They name him Shase because they want to highlight the fact that this child is in place of the other one. So Cain made a big mistake. Esav says, I'm not going to do that. And that's why the Torah says, Yikruvu yimei evel avi v'aharga esachi. I'm going to wait until my father dies, and then I will kill my brother. So Rashi says on Chumash, why is Esav waiting for his father to die? Well, he had a great kibbutz avaim. He didn't want to give his father too much heartache. You know, if his father's going to see the brothers hate each other, what, like Yaakov didn't, like Yitzchak wasn't aware that they hated each other, okay. But Esav says, I can't murder my brother while my father's alive. That would be terrible. Let me wait till he dies, and then I'm going to kill him. But the Medrash says, it was not because he had such great kibbutz avaim. The reason why he wanted to wait was because, once my father's no longer in the world, there's no possibility of another brother coming into the equation. Let me wait to kill my brother until my father dies. This way I've rid myself of the Jewish problem. I don't have the issue anymore. And that is what he tried to do. History continues on, and along comes Paro. And Paro says, let me learn from the mistakes of those who came before me. You see, I also need to exterminate the Jewish people. I also need to find the final solution. And how does he do that? He looks back at the story of Esav, he looks back at the story of Cain, and he says, let me study history to try to understand what is the best way to go about doing this. Obviously, Esav was not successful. Look what's happening. Uvenei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu. Right? The Jewish people proliferated. They were all over the place in Mitzrayim. So how do we get rid of them? This is a major problem. Havan ischak malo. Paro says, I'm scared the Jewish people are growing by leaps and bounds. What do I do? So Paro comes along with a plan. And he says, you look back at Esav, and the mistake that he made was this. You see, he wanted to wait to kill his brother until his father died. This way there would be no possibility of another member of the family in the place of Yaakov. But there was a big mistake that he didn't take into account. He didn't factor in. What was that mistake? That all those years that he was waiting, Yaakov was having his own children. And they were having grandchildren. And now the Jewish people were too big to destroy. Power says, I'm not going to make that mistake. I'm going to kill the Jewish children immediately when they're born, so they don't have the opportunity to have children and to grow the Jewish community larger. And he says, I'm not going to make the mistake that Cain made. I'm not going to make the mistake that Esav made. I'm going to get it right. I'm going to kill the children immediately. Now part of his plan was, the females, I can keep them alive. If there's no Jewish men for them to marry, they're going to marry out. And ultimately, the Jewish people are going to be destroyed anyway. So I don't have to kill everybody. I don't need everybody knowing that I'm a total monster. So I'll kill the boys. I'm going to kill them immediately when they're born, so they can't have the opportunity to have children. But I'm going to keep the women alive. Why not? Let them marry Egyptian men. It will help our economy. It will help everything. That was the plan. Where did Paro fail? Comes along Haman, says the Medrash, and he studies everybody who came before him, and he says, this was a major mistake. Paro obviously didn't get it right, because here I am so many years later, and I'm still dealing with the Jewish problem. And we have not gotten rid of them. And the world is still having problems from the Jewish community. So what do we do? So Haman comes along and he says, let's study what was the mistake of Paro. In the Megillah it says, Vidaseyem shonos mikol am. What does that mean? When they're describing the plan to eradicate the Jewish community, to destroy them, So it says part of the problem of the Jewish community is vidaseim shonos mikalam, which means we don't integrate. We have a different set of values. Daseya means their das, what we stand for, what we abide by, is very different than the rule book for the rest of the world. Shonos mikalam, it's very different. And that's why we got to get rid of them. They're not integrating properly. They're an am hanifchar. They're acting differently. They're not assimilating the way they should. The Medrash says, not exactly what it meant. Perhaps there's an alternative interpretation. Daseyam shonos mikalam is referring to one halacha that we observe that the rest of the world doesn't believe in. What is that? That the mother is the one who determines Jewishhood, nationhood. It's not the father. In the rest of the world, the father is the one who determines which community the child will be a part of. By the Jewish community, it's not the way it works. Our identity as Jews comes from our mothers. A mother is what gives the Jewish child his genetic makeup and his ability to be a part of the identity of the Jewish people. And Haman says that was Paro's mistake. Kol ha-bein ha-yilod ha-yorot ha-shlichu. Paro said, I'm going to kill all the Jewish males. His intent was, let me keep the women alive because they're going to assimilate anyway. What he didn't factor in was, even if the Jewish women will marry Egyptian men, once they have children, those children are all Jewish. So we're going to have more Jews in the world. Haman says, we're not going to make that mistake. Lahashmid, laharog, ula'abed. Look in the Pesukim in the Megillah, a very detailed plan that is outlined. Lahashmid, laharog, ula'abed, as kol ha-yehudim. Minar viad zaken, young children, because we don't want them to have children. Taf v'nashim biyom echad, men, women, doesn't matter. We got to get rid of everybody. We have to destroy the entirety of the Jewish people, and the only way to do that is to kill men, to kill women. Everybody had their own idea, and as we know, somehow Haman was also unsuccessful. And the Medrash ends off and says, we have this idea, don't ask me about it because I know nothing about it, a milchemes Gog u'Magog. There's this concept out there that before the end of days, before Mashiach, we're going to confront this overwhelming battle of milchemes Gog u'Magog. What that is, I have no idea. Some say we already had that in the Holocaust, and now we're ready for Mashiach. I really have no way of knowing. But the Medrash writes that by Milchemes Gog u'Magog, they too tried to study the mistakes of history. And they tried to learn from all those who came before them, all those murderers and monsters who came before them. What can we do differently than all those who came before us, who clearly were unsuccessful in their mission? And they say, you know, the problem is, so long as the Jewish people are connected to their father, so long as the Jewish people still have God on their team, we will never be successful in destroying them. You think God will allow us to destroy the Jewish people? What we need to do is cut the cord of connection between God and the Jewish people. And it's only then that we'll have the opportunity to really destroy them. Look what's happening in our generation. Cut the cord between God and the Jewish people. Make people lose their sense of Jewish identity. Make people lose their appreciation for what it means to be connected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and His Torah. Look what's happening. And the Medrash writes that perhaps this is what the Pasuk means in the beginning of Sefer Tehillim. Ninatka Mosrosemo. Pasuk says, I think it's the first or second chapter of Tehillim, Ninatka esmos rosemo v'nashlicha mimenu avosemo. You look it up later. What it means is, we're going to cut the cable, and we're going to take those very tough cords that connect something, and we're going to dispose of them. That's a reference to Gog u'Magog, that their idea, their understanding of how to destroy the Jewish people is to destroy their relationship with God, to destroy their appreciation for the value and the importance and the centrality of God and everything He represents in their lives. That is their attempt to destroy us. And the next pasuk in Tehillim writes, Yoshe b'shamayim Yitzchak. HaKadosh Baruch Hu watches all of this conversation take place. And in the end, the Ribono Shel Olam sits and he laughs. It will never happen. Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo. Are we going to have many casualties along the way? Many karbanos, unfortunately, that we're seeing? Yes. Hundreds of thousands of Jews who have been destroyed either physically or spiritually, but they're not a part of our community any longer, much to our dismay? Yes. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yoshev Hashamayim Yitzchak. Ultimately, the plan will never work. It won't happen. Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo. Parshas Kisisa, which we're going to read next week. So we also read this passage on a Tainus Tzibur. Torah describes when Moshe Rabbeinu has this encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a very intimate conversation. So listen to the pasuk that we read. We'll see it next week again in the Chumash. Vayomer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Hine anochi koreis bris neged kalamcha e'esen iflaos. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm making a covenant. Neged kalamcha e'esen iflaos. To the eyes of the entire Jewish people, I will do wonders. I will do miracles. Asher lo nivru b'chal ha'aretz v'chal ha'goyim. These will be miracles that the entire world and civilization have never experienced. V'ra'a kala am asher ata b'kirbo. And when I do that, the Jewish people will be able to see asher ata b'kirbo, that I, God, am a part of who they are. Es ma'aseh Hashem kinarahu asher ani osei imach. So the pasuk describes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to do something otherworldly for the Jewish people. Something that we've never experienced. Asher lo nivru b'chal ha'aretz v'chal ha'goyim. That from the creation of the world, nobody has ever experienced anything like this. What is that? We already had Kriyas Yamsuf. We already had Matan Torah. We already had all the Makos. So the Ramban on Chumash and many other Rishonim ask, what is this referring to? What is this miracle that God is going to do for the Jewish people that is going to be greater than any experience they've ever had from the days of Bria Shamayim Va'aretz? They already had, as we mentioned, Eser Makos and Kriyas Yamsuf and Kabbalah Satorah. The Man, the Anani Akavo, the Be'er, waters coming out of rocks. There's food falling from the sky, tastes like anything they want. What greater miracle can God do? What is he referring to? We've seen it all. And the Ramban is troubled. What exactly does this mean? And perhaps the answer is based on a comment of the Chovos HaLevavos. Chovos HaLevavos writes something amazing. Again, he's not describing this question of the Ramban, he's not addressing it, but I think it's a very obvious answer to this question. I'm going to read his words. Im yivakesh adam mizman hazeh leros. If somebody in our generation would want to see, mahu dome le'inyanim ahem, how do I have the opportunity? You know, I say to myself, sometimes high school members of our community will ask, you know, I'm troubled, I understand that you're troubled, but they say, what would happen if God would just come and do Kriyas Yamsa for me? I wouldn't be troubled. If God would come and talk to me the way he spoke to so many generations prior to me, it would be very easy to believe in God. So why can't God just do that? So the Chovos HaLevavos says, there were high school kids who asked him the same question. It would be much easier to be a believer if we had Kriyas Yamsuf. God, do me a favor. Come one day and just bring us Kriyas Yamsuf. I think the answer to that is very simple. Look carefully at the news coming out of Eretz Yisrael every single day. Chovos HaLevavos does not write this. But read between the lines and understand the miracle of Jewish survival. Does it make sense? The Iron Dome, is that less of a miracle than Kriyas Yamsuf? I'm sure you've seen those pictures of when there's 50 rockets flying into the air at the same time, and then you have the counter rockets coming, and you have this whole light show in the middle of the sky, and we all think it's cute. Talk to someone who lives on the border there, it's not cute at all. Miraculous! That is Bria Shamayim Va'aretz, that is Kriyas Yamsuf, that is the Makos, that is the Man, the Be'er, Anani Akavod, all in one. We don't see it because it just comes up on the news, and it's technology, it's amazing. But we all have smartphones and we all have ways that we can appreciate technology, so we don't think about it. So the same way a genius came up with a smartphone and a computer and a laptop, somebody came up with an Iron Dome, what's the big deal? It's a miracle, understand that. It's God talking to all of us. Does it make sense that thousands of rockets are shot at Achenu B'nai Yisrael and almost never Do they get to their target, to their destination? It doesn't make sense. There's no country in the world that would ever have such a thing. And we only see it there. But writes the Chovos HaLevavos, you ask yourself, I live in 2022. And here I am, and I just want to see God. But I can't find him. He's hiding. It's not so easy. As we know, the Navi refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the Kel Mistater. By design, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden. There's a reason for it. The Baal HaTanya describes what the reason is. But here I am, I'm just a simple person. I want to see the Ribono Shel Olam. I want to see miracles. Show me that you're here. Give me a sign. Every once in a while in our lives, we have the opportunity to see that. People wait for a Yeshua. They ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, show me. And it comes through. But for most people, it's not the way life is lived. And we're lost. Writes the Chovos HaLevavos, Yabit Be'ein HaEmes. Take everything away that's clouding your vision. And have the opportunity to give yourself a moment of clarity. Think about this. Amadnu Be'ein HaUmos Me'es HaGalos. We have stood as a people from the day of Churban Beis HaMikdash. V'sidur inyanenu b'neihem. And the fact that we have built communities in every location where we have been dislocated to. Imashanu bilti maskimim imayim b'seser uvagaloi. We inwardly and outwardly reject everything that society stands for and believes in. We're clear about our principles and what we stand for. We don't back down. We're not ashamed. We stand for a totally different set of values, and we're very open and transparent about it. And we are not ashamed to tell the world what we feel and how we act and how we practice our religion. And with all of that, hiding in basements to do mitzvos, going out in public to do what we want to do, serving our HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way we feel is the right way to do it, with all of that, it's no secret. The way we practice, and with all of that, we're still here. You want to see Kriyas Yamsuf? Look at the fact that we have a community. That we have a shul. That we have a yeshiva. That we have a girls' school. That we have a day school. That we have communities the way we have here in the United States. That is Kriyas Yamsuf, says the Chovos HaLevavos. What about that makes sense? How can that be? How is it possible? When we lost so many along the way, when we practice a religion and a set of values that is so distant from the world that we live in, we're looked at as dinosaurs. You still believe in that old Torah? Still believe in those traditions? You ever engage in a conversation with somebody who doesn't believe? They have lots of good questions. Not always do we have the right answers. It's a good question. But a lot of very firm believers. So this rabbi that I was meeting with a few months ago told me, and we've been in touch since a bunch, you know, she said, I can just tell you that a couple of years ago I had no choice but to sign on to a tshuva being mater intermarriage. Look, we don't have a choice. We're going to disappear. So if I'm not going to give in on intermarriage, then what's going to be with us? We're going to have no one. What a tragedy. Well-meaning, but a tragedy. And here we are, 5 or 6 years after that document was signed, and by her own admission, at least half of her community don't even know how to read Hebrew. Don't know how to identify Aleph Beis. She asked me, you know, I've listened to some of your classes. Would you come if I got a couple of hundred high school kids from my community? Would you come teach them? To be honest, I wouldn't even know what to teach. I felt almost like Reb Lazer Silver after the war when he went into the monasteries and said, it's not the same at all, but when he said Shema Yisrael, and that was the only thing the kids knew. What do you say when somebody grows up and knows absolutely nothing? Never been to a synagogue in his or her life. Never experienced Yiddishkeit authentically in their lives. Where do you start? What do you say? writes the Chavos HaLevavos, with all of that, with all of those challenges, you want to see Kriyas Yamsuf in modern day reality as we live it? Look at the fact that we're here. This is the greatest miracle. So when Moshe Rabbeinu was promised, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to show something so phenomenal to the Jewish people, Asher lo nivru b'chala aretz v'chala gayim, that the world has never experienced before. And when we look at that miracle, we're going to realize, Asher atav kibo, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is here with us. What is that miracle, asked the Ramban? What could it be? We've seen everything. But what is the miracle that's being referred to? The answer is, the miracle is us. You are the miracle. Our children are that miracle. Our community is the miracle. That is the greatest miracle, greater than Bria Shamayim Va'aretz. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, about 250 years ago, he passed away in 1776, an important year in history. But Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote in his Siddur, a very famous line, he says, Eich lo yevosh hakofer bahashgacha. How is someone not ashamed to claim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not mashgiach over the world, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't look after the world? V'yamo nichlam, how you're not going to be embarrassed? Mishe ya'ayin b'yichad in yanenu ma'amadenu ba'olam. The chart of Jewish history again, 250 years ago, this is what he writes. Anachnu ha'uma ha'gola, we are the abandoned nation. Se pizura, we are forsaken. Echad achar kol ma she'aver aleinu, after everything that has happened to us, mehatzaros hatmuros alafim mehashanim, we have suffered misery for thousands of years. Ve'in uma ba'olam nifredas kamonu, there is no nation in the world that keeps its own identity as we have. Marabim hayutzarenu, how painful have our enemies been in their approach to the Jewish community. They have tried to annihilate us. They have tried to eradicate and obliterate the Jewish religion. And yet, every one of those powerful nations is gone. There's no shadow, there's no shred of influence that is left from their reality and from their power. But us, who believe and hold on to our identity with the Ribono Shel Olam, Kulanu Chaim Hayom, here we are, and nothing has changed. And we're learning the same Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu learned. B'chol tokef arichas galusenu, afilu os v'nikud achas mehatorah shebichsav, v'divrei chachamim kayamim. The Gemara, the Talmud, is here the way it was 2,000 years ago. The psukim in Chumash that we follow, that we believe in, have not changed one iota. Thousands of years, many different cycles and gilgulim of Jewish history and communities and uprooting and destruction, and here we are. Lo shalat bahem yad hazman. Time has not eroded what the Jewish people are. Ma yana bazeh filosof harif. If you are a very intelligent philosopher who studies the philosophy of history and you try to understand this, hayad hamikra asasa kalela. Is this just accidental? Is this just by chance? This reality? Writes Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Chai Nafshi, I promise you, he says, Ki b'hizbonot ibn iflo seila, when I think about these amazing wonders, Godlu etzla yosar mikol nisim in iflos she'asa Hashem yizbarach la'abuseinu b'mitzrayim u'bamidbar. This is greater to me than any miracle that we experienced in the desert, by Yitzias Mitzrayim, Kriyas Yamsuf, this is greater. V'chol ma she'erech hagalus yoser, and the longer that our exile endures, the longer and the more intense that it becomes, again, 250 years ago, imagine what's been since. Noda ma'isa tukfa u'gvaraso. The miracle just becomes more expanded and more intense than it ever has been. You know, if Rabbi Yaakov Emden 250 years ago writes that what he's experienced and what he's seen in Jewish history is greater than Kriyas Yamsuf and all the Makos, what would he say today? 250 years later, so much more destruction has happened. greatest genocide of the Jewish people that has ever been in the history of the Jewish people. And here we are. It's not greater than the Makos and Kriyas Yamsuf. It's greater than Bria Shamayim Va'aretz. It's the greatest miracle ever in the history of the world, which is exactly what the Pesukim tell us in Parshas Kisisa. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, E'eseh niflaos asher lo nivru b'chol ha'aretz v'chol ha'goyim. I'm going to do something that nobody will be able to believe. You're going to be so shocked when you just take a step back and appreciate and understand what that miracle is. And what is that miracle? That miracle is all of us. That miracle is our children. That miracle is that Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never fail us, and that we will never fail Him. And yes, it's a tragedy that so many have forgotten what it means to be the Am HaNivchar, what it means to be different, what it means to stay separate, what it means to uphold the principles and values and the commitment and the fidelity to a Torah lifestyle and to mitzvah observance. Yes, many have forgotten that. But our job, if we're not Kiruv professionals, our job is not to look upon anyone else, but to look inward. And to think, for all those who forgot what Am HaNivchar means, let's make a concerted effort to remind ourselves of what it means to be the Am HaNivchar. What does it mean to be the Jewish people? What does it mean to live the lives that we live? Why are we privileged and blessed to live this existence and this experience? Why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing this for us in particular? What does it mean for me? What kind of values and meaning does it give to my life? And it's an opportunity for all of us, again, as we mentioned, it's a sad reality that we're talking about, but it's an uplifting time for us to think why we are targeted, why we are different, what it is that's unique and special about who we are and what we represent. And I just felt that with all the negativity going around, once again, it's an opportunity for us to be positive and to think in a positive way for ourselves and for our children and our grandchildren about what a privilege it is. Atavar chartano mikol ha'amin. We have been chosen. Ahavta osanu v'ratzisavanu v'romamtana mikol ha'lashonos. Being part of the Am HaNivchar does not mean that you have a right to look down negatively on others. Being part of the Am HaNivchar means living up to responsibility. Means living a certain code of life that HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects of all of us. Because we are chosen and we are different and we need to remain different. And that is the miracle of Jewish continuity. That is the miracle of Jewish life that has always continued to sustain us and that will continue to expand as our community continues to grow and continues to develop. So I wish everyone a wonderful